Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt the Bud Knight.
And I'm Sir Jimmy of House Nuts. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we're into Tyrion 4 of A Storm of Swords. That's right, you heard it correct, folks. We're actually doing the reread on our book club podcast. We're back with the reread after doing a guide last week to kind of reset and get ready post House of the Dragon season, waiting for the Dunkin' Egg show, of course. But this is not the off season, I can tell you that, because I loved being back in this Tyrion chapter this week. But Matt, I got to ask the ever burning question: how are you?
Dude, I'm doing good. Like you said, it's good to be back in the reread. Good to be back to sort of the structure of this whole thing. Yeah, I'm. I am glad we did that guide, because I've been wanting to do that for a long time, to just break down like, here's all the stuff that exists, because there's kind of a lot actually. You kind of forget about some of the other stuff that's going on, and it was fun to just dive back into the books, you know, as well as diving into World of Ice and Fire. Picked up my Rise of the Dragon book,
let's go,
and started pulling through that. And it's like, wow, you know, you forget a lot of the cool artwork and stuff that's inside of that thing, as well as the Fire and Blood content. And yeah, I mean, you know, hey, we might get Blood and Fire at some point soon, right? George has talked about that, which could be pretty cool to get a lot more of this lore and mythos. And Dunkin' Egg just finished filming.
It did. It wrapped up in Northern Ireland. And so interesting. I was just there. Actually, one of the early sites, so the prologue for the first episode of Game of Thrones, where the White Walkers like kill all the wildlings and leave them in like a symbol in the snow. They actually filmed there. They filmed there again for Dunkin' Egg. It's not going to be connected. It's just like a really beautiful area.
It's just a good spot. Yeah.
So it's like the haunted forest area that's actually going to be in the Dunkin' Egg show. Oh, well, I should say they filmed there. Who knows if we'll make it into the final cuts, but they did film a decent amount of footage there, apparently. So kind of neat that I was there just like a week after they were there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. Well, yeah. So I think for a lot of people might be listening to our rereads for the first time. So typically we'll be going chapter by chapter. And again, it is a reread, so there will be tons of spoilers in here. And Jimmy and I usually start. Sometimes if there's a little bit of news, we'll talk about it. And there happens to be this week. So like we said, we're back in the books. But first, we got to talk a little about House of the Dragon.
Drama alert.
Yeah, here we go. It's just infighting. The whole thing's weird. I don't really like it. So
I'm not having fun.
Yeah, pretty much. So a tweet was put out and by Westerosi, so I think is just pretty much like the best sort of Twitter account to track like everything that's going on with anything Westeros related, which is a reference as a Deadline article in which they were talking to Casey Blois. I think it's Blois is how it's pronounced, B-L-O-I-S, who is the head of HBO. And he denied that fans were divided over season 2's quality and cites that only maybe one fan was in regards to George R.R. Martin's recent criticisms. Now, quickly, I'll say it's a little hard to tell from an article whether that was sarcastic or it was like heated towards George, because George is talking on his Not a Blog about like working with. I mean, he's working on the Dunkin' Egg show.
I think that might come to an end rather soon.
I don't know. It's hard to tell.
I think he clearly pissed people off with this, you know, and it's his right to do that. To say that the audience is not divided, I think is a bit disingenuous. But like you said, this could be a sarcastic comment. Like this could be like kind of tongue in cheek. Hard to say. I'm not going to read into it too much. What I will say, though, is that I feel as if the internet is pretty divided. I don't think that it's as polarizing as maybe it seems to like the general population, as far as just like people who listen to the story, and then tune out and don't go to Reddit or wherever, which is the majority of people, believe it or not. I think that I'm positive there's probably plenty of general viewers that are saying that, hey, season two is a little slow. Kind of wish I would have had 10 episodes, you know, kind of moved on. But the like season eight meltdown that we saw online, I actually don't think that that is super valid, right? Like, I think people are probably more conflicted about the episodes being cut rather than decisions that were made. But, you know, I don't know. I don't think that saying that the audience wasn't split is true. I think that people were pretty upset, at least on the internet, very loud. So kind of a weird take here, but he said, hey, it was successful. So
it matters.
Yeah, I would say, and that's the thing. These CEOs and executives are way out of touch with the fan base. Obviously, all they care about is numbers. And if it did numbers, we'll see another season. So
yeah, they're working. Yeah, it's going to see four seasons unless season three, something bad would have to happen to where season three is so terrible that.
And who knows?
Maybe we don't know. Maybe the budget is so awful for season three that it never happens. But I will say it's just something to keep an eye on, just because simply George has said he's working on Dunkin' Egg, which, you know, even from what George is saying, that could be the thing where he's like, well, I can't. He's like, I'm not working on season three of House of the Dragon because I'm working more on Dunkin' Egg. And maybe it is because he doesn't like Ryan. He's upset with Ryan Kendall and all this other stuff. Or maybe it's simply he's like, I want to help get that started. Right. I mean, he didn't do everything in Game of Thrones. At the same time, Warner Brothers they're used to dealing with crazy authors because they deal with J.K. Rowling all the time. So
she's
fine. And he's it. Yeah. I mean, she is infinitely worse than George Martin.
Yeah, I think a lot of fans are on George's side. I don't know how many people are really on J.K. Rowling's side.
Right.
I don't think it's the majority.
Yeah, I mean, even outside of her political beliefs, J.K. Rowling comes across as like crazy, and she's constantly changing the canon of the story to be whatever it wants, whatever she wants it to be, like on Twitter. Like, oh, actually, now this character did this. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, so it would be incredibly difficult to follow.
Very, very difficult to follow. Yeah. Dude, I the thing to keep in mind is that we already knew this, but it's become very evident that George doesn't have any power over these shows and has very little say, unless if they want to be gracious towards him. And I can't imagine that these executives who do make the final calls above Ryan Condell, above any of the other writers or whatever, are going to give George much say in anything. So I think it's going to be more of like, what does HBO let George even do at this point? Like, it's going to be interesting to see. He signed it away, so
gotta wait and see.
He could
what's his name, Andre, I forget his last name, Wachowski or whatever it is, the Witcher guy. He's had complaints as well, but I mean, Netflix, it's obvious Netflix has botched that show. So I mean,
that's the weird thing, you know. I get there's valid complaints. We had complaints about season two House of the Dragon, but like, I like Witcher more so for the video games and the books. I only read the first short story collection, liked it a lot, but like, I'm not like an avid fan, but I do know avid fans of the Witcher series, and folks, they got it a lot worse than anything we did. You know, you want to talk about a season eight level kind of drop off.
I didn't even watch season three. It's like, what's the point?
I tried, and I was not having fun. I think it's a pretty bad adaptation, unfortunately. And that was coming from someone who liked season one and two.
Yeah, I like both. I like season two more, actually.
Yeah, it wasn't a perfect show, but it was entertaining. Yeah, I, you know, and Henry Cavill was fun, and I actually thought the actress that played Yennefer was pretty amazing and serious. I mean, I don't know. I liked the casting, and the actors' performances were good, but the writing was just a little rough around the edges in one and two still. And then when I started watching season three, it was you're right. It just felt like, well, why? Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point to watch it because, you know, Henry Cavill's not coming back. And then they're getting Thor's brother, Liam Hemsworth, to play him.
And he could do a great job.
He could. He's not even going to get a chance to be successful.
Yeah, it's not going to be anybody else's fault other than the showrunners / writers for it. You know, after they said that they basically crapped on the fandom. You just can't do that.
The best thing that show could do is tie it into the next Witcher game, which we know is in development. So, I mean, if they're like, hey, season four is just going to be a TV adaptation or some sort of tie in to the next Witcher game, which who knows when that's coming out. That might be the only thing that could save season four of The Witcher. And I don't think it's going to have anything to do with it.
It'll be interesting, though, because there's going to be a whole new generation then to playing Witcher 4. And maybe that will end up sparking people to want to watch the TV show. Like, we might see a renaissance. Yeah, you never know. So I'm just still waiting on my Song of Ice and Fire video game, just patiently, just waiting for it not to be a Facebook casino real game. But
it's right, or whatever.
At this point.
Yeah. Or not given to a studio that shuts down. So, yeah. All right. Hey, with that, I think that's enough of the books. But I will say real quick, Jimmy and I did discuss on Patreon George's blog post, the one that he put up and deleted, as well as began discussing a little bit about now, since George sort of spoiled is kind of a loose word over with that, because we know the events, but we didn't know what events we were getting in season three or season four. George actually did kind of spoil some of that, which did cause us to change our outline, which we're also going to come back and do another Patreon episode with that new information, where we pretty much know, hey, this event looks like it's taken place in season three. Okay, I think now we can actually kind of piece together seasons three and four and see exactly how that timeline.
It became a lot tougher after George's blog post, actually, because we're like, how are they going to fit all this in? This is going to be crazy.
Yeah, because now it seems like season three might be a whole lot, but yeah, a little interesting. So anyway, so we're going to come back and do a big Patreon episode about that with now our new information, where we can say, okay, if this is in season three, then we can pinpoint it here, and this should be the outline for the rest of the show. But enough about House of the Dragon. Let's get into the chapter. So here we are, Tyrion 4 of A Storm of Swords. Mm-hmm. Tyrion visits Simon Silvertongue and thanks him to pay him to leave King's Landing. But the singer wishes to join the tournament of singers that will take place during Joffrey's wedding. He blackmails Tyrion by indicating that he will tell him about his relationship with Shay. Tyrion promises him that one of the other singers will be removed and Bronn will visit him in 3 days' time. Outside, Tyrion orders Bronn to kill Simon. Later, Tyrion's father shows him the two new Valyrian swords that he had made for Joffrey and Jaime. Master Topo Mott reworked the metal, and the color of the blade on each sword is black and red. House Lannister has not had a Valyrian sword in hundreds of years, and try as he might, Tywin could never get any of the lesser houses to sell theirs. Where the steel from these new swords came from is not revealed. Of course, we know where it's from. Tywin tells him that he must consummate his marriage to Sansa, and that Mace Tyrell rejected the marriage proposal between Cersei and Willis, probably because the Queen of Thorns told him to. Pycelle brings dire tidings from the Wall, and that Maester Aemon fears Lord Mormont is dead. Tywin tells Pycelle to send a veiled message that no men shall be sent to the Wall unless Jaina Slynt is considered for the post of Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. Tyrion thinks to himself that he should have had Slynt and Pycelle put to death when he had the chance. So
a lot of stuff here.
A lot of cool stuff. A lot of theories we're going to dive into. And, you know, actually, one of the things I was thinking about, and I was thinking this is actually one of the better things about, especially earlier seasons of Game of Thrones, the show, is that we do actually get some conversations in the show between Tywin and the Queen of Thorns, right? Lady Olenna Tyrell. Mm-hmm. And they do actually have a sit down conversation. And it's like, now we're just hearing about in the books, hey, they had a conversation and this is what they decided. And that's like one of those things I do like about especially like the earlier seasons of Game of Thrones, like that conversation that's, you know, there's scenes that are definitely not in the book anywhere. And like season one is so close to the show, but there are some pretty cool conversations that feel like they could have taken place in Game of Thrones. I mean, once you get to the later stuff, it's like now we're missing a lot of stuff, so it's hard to tell how close we are. But at least here, you can be like, oh, maybe that conversation that they included in the show, like, you know, headcanon wise, you can kind of piece it here because it doesn't really change a lot of things. Like the conversation that Robert has with Cersei, you know, the conversation that Jaime has with Ned, right? You know, with about, oh, is that what you tell yourself at night? Like some of those things you can kind of piece into your headcanon if you want. And like they do have a conversation where they are, you know, discussing terms before the wedding.
Yeah, it's interesting that Gurm is able to accomplish so much through certain POVs, and like it's always interesting on who he selects in the books to see these things and to hear about them. And for instance, Tyrion being around and hearing about the Wall, and we know that Tyrion obviously has a relationship with the Wall from the beginning of the series. He also has a lot of feelings about the Tyrells. He talks about the Tyrells long before he ends up having a conversation with his dad in this chapter, and he's talking about how the Tyrells are bringing things in. Inflation is very high since Blackwater. And one thing the summary doesn't really mention, but I think is pretty key, is the fact that Tyrion is walking through the Mudgate, where he has obviously had many memories now from Blackwater. And we're seeing the kind of the aftermath of Blackwater as Tyrion walks through. And things seem pretty testy around the small folk.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just get this opening line here, because I think it's a really strong paragraph. Mm-hmm. Nothing remained beyond the King's Gate but mud and ashes and bits of burned bone. Yet already there were people living in the shadow of the city walls, and others selling fish from barrows and barrels. Tyrion felt their eyes on him as he rode past, chilly eyes, angry and unsympathetic. No one dared speak to him or try to bar his way, not with Bronn beside him in his oiled black mail. If I were alone, though, they would pull me down and smash my face with a cobblestone, as they did for Preston Greenfield. Yeah. They'd come back quicker than the rats, he complained. We burned them out once, and you think they'd take a lesson?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, because a little bit later in the chapter, so what this is doing is setting the tone of the small folk in many ways, but also later in the chapter, we hear about the great, we hear about the Septon, the High Septon, and basically that he's a bot man, he'll do whatever. And we know that that's not going to be the case. And then whenever that shift ends up happening, and then the small folk being in the manner in which they are, you see how much the High Sparrow has influence in King's Landing. And a lot of that is set up in this chapter, which is incredible, because that doesn't happen for a whole nother book. Mm-hmm. So George was definitely laying some brickwork here, making sure that we saw the attitude of the people of King's Landing and Flea Bottom and near the Mudgate and merchants and inflation and just the state of things. And also how absolutely clueless Tywin is to the common people. And he just wants to keep spending and spending and spending, because that's what Lannisters do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, then eventually we start to hear about how much money is actually there. But yeah, there's a ton of stuff in here. And, you know, even this character that Tyrion is going to go visit, right? Simon Silvertongue.
Oh, man.
Tyrion thinks of him time and time again throughout the series, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he thinks of him in Dance of the Dragons. He confesses to Penny that he had him killed for writing a song about him. You know, then Tyrion remembers a pot shop in King's Landing that made the best bowl of brown when, you know, the second sons, this is Cam, and Cam is a character. When he asked Tyrion whether he ate a bowl of brown, Tyrion answers that he did once or twice, and he calls it Singer's Stew.
Yeah, because we hear Bronn saying, oh, they use all kinds of meat down there. And he's like, remind me never to eat there. And this is so it's very interesting. We also have to, preface this with the fact that the chapter before this, it's been many months, but it was Jaime 4, and Jaime has lost his hand, which is ironic because we're in a Tyrion chapter watching him walk around after he's lost the position of hand. So we have a meta version of hand, and then a real hand being missing. And Tyrion, whereas Jaime becomes a little bit humbled and begins this almost redemption arc at this point, we see Tyrion kind of dissenting into some pretty awful things. We were happy when he sent Janos Slynt to the Wall, but now we have a singer who's written a song that makes Tyrion feel threatened. And instead of handling it any other way, he actually goes straight to violence, and he's going to have Bronn kill him. A bit of a turn for Tyrion's character, and it maybe shows us a different side of him as he's on the downside right now. He's not in favor in King's Landing. So, you know, him losing the title of hand and then Jaime losing his physical hand, I think is a kind of a comparison that we can make here.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Tyrion immediately also starts thinking about, I mean, he immediately starts going into the, he starts going into like, how this is how much it's going to cost to rebuild and everything. But real quick, I just want to back up actually to that Jaime chapter, because it's kind of interesting. And this is one of those things where we talk about like the connection of like the end of a previous chapter and the beginning of a new chapter, because in A Song of Ice and Fire, as we go point of view, it feels like often like look at the map, right? And you're like, okay, now we're with Jon in the Wall, just like the show did, right? Where it's like, okay, and now you go, you shift all the way down here to King's Landing, and then you shift all the way over to here to Essos. But if you go back to that Jaime chapter, as Qyburn is getting him prepared, they're talking a little bit about like what happened with Tyrion. Right. And so Qyburn is saying, this is the chapter before, you know, tell me about of the battle. He's asking about the battle that, you know, with Tyrion and everything. And he said, Lord Stannis was caught between your father and the fire. It is said the imp set the river itself aflame. Jaime saw green flames reaching up to the sky higher than the tallest towers as burning men screamed in the streets. I've dreamed this dream before. It was almost funny, but there was no one to share the joke, which Tyrion, we think of Tyrion, he is like a jokester and all this stuff. We immediately go to the Tyrion chapter in which Tyrion is now riding through the Mudgate and looking at bits of burned bone and ash and all of these things, and looking at the aftermath of this whole war. It's just something that George does in his writing that is just so great, because he is able to accomplish like 16 things with one line. And it's why Winds of Winter is probably taking as long, and we've said this for years, is because, okay, like in just reading that little thing of Jaime, okay, it's, you in one hand you could say, okay, that's Jaime dreaming about the king burning everything, right? Because that's his whole deal, right? Or it could have to do with Cersei potentially blowing up the Sept of Baelor in the future, or it could do with the battle with the White Walkers in the future, or why is Jaime dreaming this dream? Was he dreaming it because he's just had a dream about it, like even before? So is it prophetic, or is it like PTSD from what could have happened? Or is it tied to, you know, Tyrion and this battle as well? So it's just so interesting that you're able to do that while tying it into the next chapter.
Yeah.
And like setting in a way, because it's only like, if you just look at it's like one paragraph before essentially this chapter begins. And so you're also able to tie it in immediately, if you're just reading page by page, to this beginning chapter here where Tyrion is now seeing the aftermath of this war. And so it's so interesting.
And it's Tyrion walking through a battlefield, right? Not Jaime the warrior, which is so interesting, because early in A Song of Ice and Fire, Jaime is off making victories before he gets taken captive. And Tyrion is captured, right? That's kind of what kicks it all off. But they end up flipping by the end of Clash of Kings, and Jaime is now captured, and Tyrion is in the battles. How interesting is that? And then here, you know, we're getting perception. Perception is huge in Song of Ice and Fire of the folk, and Tyrion's obviously not considered to be much of a mighty warrior, but we know the truth. We know that the Hound ran. We know that Joffrey backed off. We know that Tyrion was the brave one. And it makes you... You know, I always think about Jaime at what he thinks of Tyrion. Like, does he think Tyrion would even be capable of that? Like, does he know deep down that Tyrion's capable of that? I'm not sure. But Jaime has a lot of dreams in this series. And some of them, I think, are endgame things. I think he sees some White Walker battles at some point. I can't remember if it's this book or if it's in A Feast for Crows. It's one of them. And I'm sure we'll get to it at some point. But it is definitely a thing to pay attention to, the way that George sequences these chapters and the way he ends chapters and the way he opens up chapters. There's also something a little bit further on. I'm just going to jump a little bit ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm only going to do this because I think it's appropriate to mention it now. But we hear a little bit about this song. And one of the lines that is repeated is, "For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm." And I think it's interesting that the hand of gold that we're going to see here in a few chapters is going to be Jaime's hand, which is cold because it's not real. And the woman's hands that are warm in this regard, I think, would be Brienne. So it's kind of a two-purpose line in many ways, because clearly we're talking about Hands of Gold. Tyrion have Hands of Gold because he's rich, and then the Hands of Shay that are warm, and that's all he really desires. But also, it kind of works with Jaime. So Tyrion and Jaime's mirroring is
it's great.
It's great, and it's all throughout the series. It's very much an echo that we constantly hear as we
read. Yeah, and even if you go back, you know, Jaime says when he in that, and just again, this is just a couple paragraphs before, if you're thinking about it as like one page to the next, mm-hmm. even though it's, you know, they're separated by chapters, is, you know, Jaime saying it was almost funny, but there was no one to share the joke. Well, who would Jaime joke with? Tyrion. Then immediately we jump into a Tyrion chapter. Now, as Tyrion is walking around in this opening, like it's like the third paragraph, he says, "I've seen enough for now. We'll return on the morrow with the guild masters to go over their plans." He sighed. "Well, I burned most of this. I suppose it's only just that I rebuild it." And in a way, you know, Jaime is getting his hand burned like a second ago, because, you know, cauterizing the wound and dealing with the wound. In a way, you could make an argument that Tyrion is the one who causes Jaime to get his hand cut. Because, I mean, it's the thing that kicks off. I mean, obviously, you could go back and say it's Bran or whatever, but I mean, it is Tyrion getting captured.
Yeah.
By Catelyn that kicks the whole kind of, I mean, that's the real, like,
yeah, talk about a butterfly,
kicks effect. Everything off. Yeah, right. I mean, that's the whole thing, is Tyrion's the one who gets captured. And I mean, Tyrion could have just went to King's Landing with everyone, but he's like, well, I want to go see the wall, so he goes with Jon Snow. If he doesn't do that and Tyrion just goes to King's Landing with everyone else as they return, so many things would not have happened.
Always being inquisitive. And it's interesting what we always ask, you know, Tyrion likes to read and all these things. And we talk about how he has to sharpen his mind, like one, his sword. But one of the biggest influences on this was actually, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this name, I always mess it up, but it's Jyrion Lannister, which was Tywin's youngest brother, who ends up going to try to retrieve Bright Roar, the Valyrian steel sword, and then is never seen ever again. And if we remember, he's actually the one who gave Tyrion, I believe, his first book, which was really, really important. It's Wonders and Wonders Made by Man by Lammas Longstrider, and often had Tyrion recite the 16 wonders of the world. Geryon, however you want to say it, also taught Tyrion some tumbling tricks when he was 6 or 7 and would praise his skills. So the obvious canon that we got dropped on us in the first book, that Tyrion could do this like tumbling trip off the gate.
I think George wishes he had never done.
Oh, without a doubt. I think that there's a chance that his uncle was going to play a bigger role in the story, and the story simply outgrew that, because the whole idea of him going on a mission for this lost sword and then disappearing, and him being so influential on Tyrion, is kind of an interesting storyline. I don't think we'll ever see him again. I think he's dead, but it's just interesting that Tyrion's inquisitive nature, we're kind of reminded of it constantly, but here we actually get mention of who inspired him. And it's someone that he thinks about quite a bit. So very cool stuff.
Yeah. And some people think that Tyrion, this, you know, ultimately Tyrion, where he's at, you know, in A Dance with Dragons, is a lot of people think Tyrion's going to run into, I mean, those are sort of the Tyrion, big Tyrion theories right now, as well as like just House Lannister theories, is that Tyrion over in Essos, you know, where we finish with Dance with Dragons, is going to run into all kinds of people. And people think Geryon, or I think it's, I don't know how you want to pronounce it, Lannister, is somebody Tyrion could run into or see his ship. Or Tyrion might find Bright Roar, right? There's also Tysha he might run into, you know, his old wife. And he's with Jorah Mormont, and Jorah might run into his ex-wife, who might be over there. And
they might do a wife swap episode.
Who knows, man? I mean, that's what it's all coming down to. But that is certainly something. So, yeah, I mean, this is one of these chapters. This chapter actually drops kind of a lot of, like, sort of deep lore theories we'll get into here as well.
Yeah, definitely. And Bright Roar is definitely a big part of that whenever we get to the Valyrian steel portion of it. But, you know, it's kind of amazing some of the things that are just dropped in this chapter. Like, we hear about Baelish going to Lyza Arryn. We hear about Jon Arryn and Robert's relationship. Obviously, Janos Slynt is here. We talk about Harrenhal. Like, the amount of stuff that's touched on in this chapter is just kind of insane. And none of it feels super forced. It's almost just like little breadcrumbs for you to think about. But one of the biggest things I took away from this, you know, rereading, of course, is, man, Tyrion should have saw this coming with Shay. He should have seen it coming, because there's a line where, he kind of has a flashback that he had told Shay about Sansa Stark, but she already knew. And she said, "I don't care. She's only a little girl. You'll give her a big belly and come back to me." And that's kind of what Tyrion was hoping for. He said he was hoping for indifference. And you kind of see it. It's just a quick thought in his head, like, "Oh, thank God that's taken care of." But in reality, this shows us exactly who Shay is. Someone who loves you most of the time, right, is not going to have that reaction, whether they're a prostitute or not. It was obvious that she was using him for status, right? And I wish, and it's just one of those times where we're in the POV of the character, so we actually fall into his blind spots and biases on our first read, but you reread this a couple times and you go, man, it's right here. That's some pretty solid evidence that maybe she's not actually in love with you, Tyrion.
Yeah. And this chapter is also, I agree with that, because this chapter is also like a big, it's a pretty big character development chapter for Tyrion as well. And remember, book Tyrion is a much darker character than show Tyrion.
There's some darkness in this chapter.
Yeah. I mean, even here, you know, in the show, it comes across as, because we just don't get enough of it, that Tyrion's like, "All right, Sansa, I'm going to leave you alone. Like, you don't want anything." But here, you know, he's thinking about it and he's thinking, well, she hates me, right? You know, we have a bed and, you know, he's like, all their nights together in the great bed were another source of torment. He could no longer bear to sleep naked, as had been his custom. His wife was too well-trained to ever say an unkind word, but the revulsion in her eyes whenever she looked on his body was more than he could bear. Tyrion had commanded Sansa to wear a sleeping shift as well. "I want her," he realized. "I want Winterfell, yes, but I want her as well. Child or woman or whatever she is, I want to comfort her. I want to hear her laugh. I want her to come to me willingly, to bring me her joys and her sorrows and her lust." His mouth twisted in a bitter smile. "Yes, and I want to be as tall as Jaime and as strong as Sir Gregor the Mountain too, for all the bloody good it does." So, I mean, really what Tyrion is looking for is the same thing he's always looking for, which is just like somebody who actually appreciates and loves him for him, you know, is really what it wants to. And if that person is Sansa, then great. And if it is Shay, then, you know, that's great too. But immediately following that, unbidden, his thoughts went to Shay. Tyrion had not wanted her to hear the news from any lips but his own. So he had commanded Varys to bring her to him the night before his wedding. They met again in the eunuch's chambers, and when Shay began to undo the laces of his jerkin, he caught her by the wrist and pushed her away. "Wait," he said, "there's something you must hear. On the morrow, I am to wed." And then, you know, she knows it's Sansa.
Yeah, and this is kind of where, like, the red flag is. I do want to highlight something, though. I mean, this is... we love Tyrion, you know, he's my favorite character maybe of all time in fiction, but this is disturbing. You know, "I want her," he realized. "I want Winterfell, yes, but I want her as well, child or woman or whatever she is." So, you know, we have to remember that Tyrion is a man that is, like, weak to his desires, and that his self-control is not his greatest asset at all. And in fact, if you need further proof of this, the fact that he decides to kill old Simon Silvertongue in this chapter is, again, him kind of giving in to those desires or instincts that are not the best for a solid dude. And this is the beginning of the slow turn, you know, towards villainy, a villain arc, I think, in many ways. And that's why I was talking about him and Jaime, and Jaime's kind of on the other path and they're crisscrossing. By the end of this book, we will know that for sure. And then Jaime's on full redemption arc in A Feast for Crows. Not that he doesn't do some things that are bad, obviously.
Right.
George is never going to write a complete black and white character. But, you know, this is a disturbing line to me from Tyrion.
If you look, though, if his first thing, yes, he's.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
because I want her child or woman or whatever she is. I view that almost as, I guess, in a way as him just. It's weird because that paragraph, the first thing he thinks of when he's thinking of what he wants to do with her is, I want to comfort her. I want to hear her laugh. So in a way, at first, it is Tyrion trying to do the right thing. And then he sort of comes into, like, well, you know, her joys and sorrows and her lust. And eventually over time, she will not be as young as she is. And also in Game of Thrones and Westeros, people marry young women all the time. And Robert Baratheon was talking about possibly, you know, he's talking about Marjorie Tyrell, who's like same, you know, just around the same age as well. So, I mean, you know, you have to certainly take that into consideration as well.
I think what makes it bad is the fact that he voices to his father that she's too young. And I'll defend Tyrion a little bit here. You know, this is his inner thoughts. He does not act on it. Right. So there is, I mean, there is some restraint there. I kind of said, you know, he's just giving in to all of his instincts. To be fair, he's not giving in to this exact one. But we kind of see the descent of this whenever he decides to take care of Simon Silvertongue. And then obviously in Dance of Dragons, his issues with the prostitute over the Narrow Sea is pretty brutal. So it's just, you know, it's almost, he's almost degrading in some way. Like when you think about where he is in Dance with Dragons, like here you're seeing him saying, well, yeah, I do have this urge, but I'm kind of showing some restraint. I'm not going to act on it. I understand that it's bad. And then I think that he has a very different reaction to kind of that same instinct and same situation in the Dance with Dragons. So this is a good kind of signpost for us to look and be like, you know, look where Tyrion's at now. And then we can look at this again when we finish book five.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll go a little bit ahead because we already talked a little bit about Simon Silvertongue. Right. You know, and what Tyrion's ultimately going to do about him. I will say, you know, a little bit, they talk about a dancing bear that could be at the wedding, which just, you got to think bear, maiden fair, right? You know, a little deception that's going on there, because there will be obviously some deception going on at that wedding.
Multiple deceptions. Yeah.
You know, that could be a little thread to it, or I'm sure George was obviously very intentional in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so then we begin to talk to when he goes and he meets his father. So he wants to see you, the Hand, Lord Tywin. I recall who the Hand is, Pod, Tyrion said. I want my nose, not my wits. I lost my nose, not my wits. So he ends up going up there. A summons from Lord Tywin always had teeth. His father never sent for him to share a meal or a cup of wine. That was for certain. As he entered his lord father's solar a few moments later, he heard a voice saying, "Cherry wood for the scabbard, bound in red leather and ornamented with a row of lion's head studs and pure gold, perhaps with the garnets for the eyes. Rubies," Lord Tywin said, "garnets lack the fire," which... rubies, we know, deals with like glamoring and stuff like that, which in a way the sword ice is now taking on a new identity in with these two Valyrian steel swords. I don't know that it's going to have any glamoring capabilities, but George does like to use those same threads, and to like everything, all the colors and stones have a theme. And in a way, you could argue that is just the theme of this, is that it is changing in a way from ice to fire, because he specifically says fire.
Love it. I love it. And if another, this is a little bit deeper down the rabbit hole. So, you know, this is just me kind of reaching a little bit, but you know, there's two swords here that look like twins, and the twins will be very important location a little later in this book, right? Whenever we get the Red Wedding.
Yes.
So there's a whole lot to dissect when it comes down to these swords. And then, of course, after Joffrey is passed on, what as well will get passed on to Tommen. So also, these swords just sound so cool, like so very cool.
Oathkeeper and yeah. What's Widow's Wail?
Yeah, Widow's Wail. Yep.
Yeah. And Oathkeeper. I'm trying to think, what happens in this show? Bran just keeps it, doesn't it? Bran has it.
I honestly remember nothing.
Did we just lose? Does it just get lost?
I remember so little outside of season one and two in the show. Like even season three and four to me is very blurry.
Right, let me just think about that. Does Bran keep it? That's an interesting question. Oathkeeper. White Walker trees across her son. Okay. What the? That's the episode. I meant the sword. I will pull that up here and I will try to find that. But yeah, I mean, that's just kind of interesting to think about, because in a way, Brienne also ends up wielding it, right? She's the one who ends up wielding Oathkeeper. And if you think about a sword with rubies in it and transformation, Brienne is also undergoing like a very large transformative arc as well. So, you know, just something to keep in mind with that. I want I never even have it pulled up, the Game of Thrones wiki, because
ew.
Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I never use it. So here we go. Wiki of Westeros. Okay. Let's see here. Oathkeeper. Oathkeeper episode appearances. I don't know. I don't think anything happens to it.
We kind of forgot about Oath.
Yeah. I mean, seriously. Right.
Well, that is the problem with television shows, right? They cut things and they forget and everything else. But at least in the books, it seems that most things end up getting some sort of payoff.
Interesting. I'm sure somebody will let us know. Because I guess it's interesting. Does Jamie have it at the end, or does Brienne have it at the end? So
when we do our rewatch, we're gonna have to find out.
Yeah, that'll be a thread we'll need to keep remember. Anywho, not important to the rest of this chapter. But so let's dive back into that. So yeah, I mean, a lot of things too here is, remember, this chapter begins with Tyrion thinking, oh, I'm still in a way gonna be doing a lot of these things, a lot of these big projects, stuff like that. And once we meet with Tywin Lannister, not so much.
No, we kind of figure out, you know, he's trying to say, as you know, the master of coin, which he doesn't want to be, but he's like, all right, master coin, I'm going to tell you, we don't have the money for this. 7 courses will be plenty. And Tywin's like, you'll find the money, bud. Like, you'll find the money. And it doubly sucks, because this is a problem. Like, the debt, and it is highlighted a lot in the books. And then obviously the Iron Bank is going to have a huge role to play in Winds of Winter and a Dream of Spring. But Tyrion's going to be the one blamed no matter what happens, because he's the person he's going to be the fall guy no matter what. And it's very evident the disdain that Tyrion and Tywin have for each other, but Tyrion's still wanting that acceptance from his, you know, he doesn't even, when he said, you know, the other sword is meant for my son, no need to ask which son. Tyrion placed Jaime's sword back on the table beside Joffrey's, wondering if Robb Stark would let his brother live long enough to wield it. Yeah. Very, very interesting. He said, if Robb Stark would let his brother live long enough. That's kind of a little bit of doubt there, huh?
Yeah. You know, there's another interesting line here too. I have highlighted here. When Tyrion puts down Joffrey's sword and took up the other, if not twins, then the two were at least cousins. This one was thicker and heavier, a 1/2 inch wider and 3 inches longer, but they shared the same fine, clean lines and the same distinctive color, the ripples of blood and night. 3 fullers, a deeply incest, ran down the second blade from hilt to point. The king's sword had only 2. Joff's hilt was a good deal more ornate, the arms of it crossguard done as lion paws with ruby claws unsheathed, but both swords had grips of finely tooled red leather and gold lion's heads for pommels. So I do just kind of like the, in a way, it's, you know, he's talking about the swords, but you're also talking about Joffrey and Jaime. Mm-hmm.
Representative,
yeah. Yeah, just like, if not twins, then the two were at least cousins. So there is, in a way, kind of like some family, you know.
Oh, definitely.
You know, relation there, since I guess it's his dad and his uncle.
It's his dad and his uncle and his third cousin. I don't know.
Right.
The incest family tree gets a little tangled whenever you go down it. Tyrion loves the blade that Jaime is getting. You know, he calls it magnificent, said the blade has never felt more alive. And then, you know, as he's pondering if Robb Stark would let his brother live, he actually has a line here. And as I was reading this just now, I just realized that it's George hinting to us that there's something going on. He said, our father must surely think so, else why have this blade forged? Meaning that Tywin has some reason to believe that Jaime's coming home. And that's most likely because the deal has already been done with the Boltons at this point. So this is pretty major and a bit of a hint to things to come. And then to just a little bit further down, you see, if you do shit gold, father, find a privy and get busy, which is obviously a pretty good hint towards Tywin's end at the end of this book. So just, I mean, just breadcrumbs everywhere for us to pick up on reread, and it makes it such a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some other lines here too. You know, so they talked about the sword, right? So you said the steel is sufficient for two blades, not three. If you have need of a dagger, take one from the armory. Robert left 100 when he died. Agarian gave a gilded dagger with an ivory grip and a sapphire pommel for a wedding gift, and half the envoys who came to court tried to curry favor by presenting his grace with jewel-encrusted knives and silver inlay swords. I just kind of like that it's like, oh, is that still tying in perhaps the mystery of that dagger, which now is with House of the Dragon is like blown all over the place, because now it's like, well, okay, well, there's way more to that than it, perhaps it just being like Baelish's dagger, or was it Rhaegar's, or all that stuff. But that was, for you know, still in the books is a big deal about like the, because Tyrion talks about actually having a dagger, you know, and like that he used that like a hunting dagger once. So it's just, you know, because we still don't, there is still quite a bit of mystery to the Valyrian steel dagger.
Yeah. When I was reading this and talking about daggers, I was wondering if this is supposed to be kind of a memory jar thing. And then he talks about Robert's hunting knife that John Arryn gave him, which I thought was actually just really nice to, because we had Peter Baelish earlier mentioned with Lysa Tully. He said, oh, she's going to go with, he's going to go over to Lysa Tully. And then you get John Arryn and Robert, and it's kind of helping you piece together the fact that maybe Peter Baelish and Lysa had planned John Arryn's death, which again, at the end of this book, we find out. So there's another breadcrumb in this chapter, one chapter, 12 pages, like five breadcrumbs for things to come. It's kind of insane.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Tons. So, we kind of continue on a little bit here too. And, you know, they start to talk about the Tyrells a little bit and the wedding costs. You know, the Tyrells, well, I'm not reading that word. Okay.
I hate it every time George uses it.
Yep. Definitely not saying that. He says, I will have the wedding and the waterfront. If you cannot pay for them, say so, and I shall find a master of coin who can. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. So continuing on with that master of coin business. Then they talk a little bit about Varys here. I am pleased, you know, so he's saying, so the talk has reached even him. I have, thank you. It is the piece of furniture between the window and the hearth with the velvet canopy and the mattress stuffed with the goose down. I'm pleased you know of it. Now, perhaps you might ought to try the woman. You might ought to try and know the woman who shares it with you. When he's talking about the bed, it's like, woman, mm-hmm. child, you mean? I think Jimmy said earlier, has the spider been whispering in your ear, or do I have to my sweet sister to thank? Considering the things that went on beneath Cersei's blankets, you would think she'd have the decency to keep her nose out of this. Tell me, why is it that all of Sansa's maids are women in Cersei's service? I am sick of being spied upon in my own chambers. So, you know, it's interesting that Tyrion clearly knows Cersei's sleeping around and all this stuff, but nobody ever brings it up with Tywin.
I think he's
is that maybe a sibling thing? It's like, yeah, there's just things we don't tell dad.
I think so. It maybe shows a little bit of that restraint I talked about earlier from Tyrion's side, but also I think bringing news to Tyrion or to Tywin that he does not want to hear is going to hurt you as well. Right?
Yeah.
And also you do have to wonder if there's not a little bit of fear from he fears Cersei in a little bit, because she did try to have him murdered. Right. So I think that maybe he's worried about pushing her hand. It's a very delicate situation. Tywin's aware though. Tywin knows. Yeah, he definitely knows.
Or yeah, he just refuses to accept it. Now there is another thing here. Okay.
You know, you're going to bring it up.
You know where I'm going.
Okay? I know exactly where you're going.
Perhaps I should have married Sansa Stark to Moonboy. You might have known what to do with her. Okay. Now, here we have Tyrion understanding Moonboy knows what to do.
Moonboy might
be laying pipe, because Tyrion brings it up to Jaime, and Jaime thinks about it like, he thinks about it in like seven chapters straight. He's like, maybe Tyrion wasn't lying. Maybe Moonboy was. Maybe Cersei banged Moonboy.
Moonboy is the best gag in A Song of Ice and Fire. It is the funniest through line of the series. I love it so much. This poor court jester dude is just being used in the most disgusting ways for jokes. I mean, yeah, he also might be physically being used. Yeah, for sure. Would a Moon Boy have made a better husband than Sansa Stark? We may never know. Maybe Moon Boy ends up being the Lord of Winterfell. Maybe this is a breadcrumb.
Maybe Moon Boy is the Night King. Okay. I mean, maybe he's Azor Ahai. All right. I'm just saying, anytime Moon Boy comes up, you need to pay attention. So at the
end of it all, it's Moon Boy versus Patches. Could you imagine?
Could be. I'd love. There's it. The other one too, Butterbumps. He comes up too. Okay, so we'll continue on a little bit here too, and get talking about the end of it. So this is where they talk about Janus Slent, right? And he is sent to the Wall, and you know the Black Brothers choose their own commander. He reminded them. Lord Slent is new to the Wall. I know I sent him there, but why should they pick him over a dozen other senior men? Because his father suggested in a tone that Tyrion was quite, the simpleton. If they do not vote as they are told, the Wall will melt before it sees another man. Yes, that would work. Tyrion hitched forward. Janus Slent is the wrong man, father. We'd do better with the commander of the Shadow Tower or Eastwatch by the Sea. The commander of Shadow Tower is a Malister of Seaguard. Eastwatch is held by an Iron Man. Neither would serve his purposes. Lord Tywin's tone said clear enough. Janus Slent is a butcher's son. Tywin reminded his father forcefully. You yourself told me. I recall what I told you. Castle Black is not Harrenhal. However, the Night's Watch is not the King's Council. There is a tool for every task and a task for every tool. So, I mean, it's just interesting, really, that Tywin is so concerned about what's going on at the Night's Watch.
Well, I think he knows that he's about to have a pretty big change up in the North with Roose Bolton. And I think he knows at this point. So I think that he's probably wanting as the amount of stability that he can add, like any amount of stability he can add will help him in the long run to try to keep Roose Bolton in charge up there. So I think he's thinking that way. But like,
I think there's something else.
What do you think?
In this chapter,
okay,
we heard about the conversation that Tywin had with Elena. Now, we see that conversation in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
And there is still, however, a book theory, and even in some ways a show theory, that Tywin was also in on it, on getting rid of Joffrey in favor of Tommen.
Oh.
So he told Tyrion not to bring Shay. He's also perhaps setting Jaime up to be, he's got these Valyrian steel swords made. He's still, he wants, again, show conversation. We don't see we see a conversation in the show. We don't see in the books. He still wants Jaime to be his heir of Casterly Rock.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that could have still been something. I mean, there's still some of it. Maybe he knew that somebody's got to be the fall guy, and that fall guy might be Tyrion.
Yep.
Maybe. So that's why he's a little more concerned about what's going on at the Night's Watch. Because he knows.
And he does tell Tyrion, I was going to send you to the Wall, right? He says, I was going to send you to the Wall. We weren't going to execute you. You're out of your mind. Yeah, maybe. But also, like, I don't know if Tyrion's any safer at the Wall if Janus Slent's in charge. You know what I mean? Like, I think, in fact, Tyrion might be way worse off.
Well, it's just because I know that there might be some unrest in the North, but the North is never going to, like, the Wall should not ride down and deal with the Boltons if the Starks get, taken out.
No, they shouldn't, but
he's just playing them ahead.
Maybe. I mean, Jon Snow is up there, and he knows that Jon Snow's there, right? So that's something to consider. Hey, maybe that's it. Maybe he just wants Janus there to decapitate the only Stark left that could claim Winterfell. I mean, it could be as simple as that. But I just love the line about being like, oh, but he can be easily bought. And Tywin's like, yeah, and who's going to outbid us? Like, dang, yeah, man. Like, Tywin is one of these characters in a book that's written as a crafty person who's actually crafty. Like, we're not just told that he's wise or clever. He actually is. And it's interesting to have Gurm write this dialogue between two characters that I consider to be extremely smart, but Tywin has more experience, and George writes it in a way that I believe that. And it's just really good. This dialogue is fantastic between them, by the way, like the whole thing with Sansa and it just seamlessly flows into Janus Slent at the Wall. Like, the dialogue is just excellent, which is why they lifted so much of it verbatim for the show. 'Cause you couldn't really improve much on it, I don't think.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at the Song of Ice and Fire reread subreddit, which I always like because I just like to see what other people are saying about it, especially they go really deep into it over there and they've reread this series like, you know, 4 or 5 times. And sometimes it's not influenced by like current events like House of the Dragon being like, all right, well, now we got to think about the dagger differently. So pull up here. So the song, right? For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm. And this is from somebody on Reddit saying, as we know, because we're rereaders, in universe, reality will for once mimic the lyrics of a song. And this is pulling from another line. Tyrion slid his hand under his father's chin and twisted. The links tightened, digging into her neck. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm, he said. He gave the cold hands another twist as the warm ones beat away his tears. That's when he is killing Shay.
Dang.
Yeah, so you tie that back to this chapter. Ooh. As well.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
and I've read this, you know, this is technically, if this way through, would be like my 7th or 8th reread, and I'm still finding out new things. It's crazy.
Yeah, I know, that's the whole deal. Because sometimes we're looking for deeper theories when sometimes it's the smaller connections that are just right in front of us.
Yeah.
The problem is that there are so many deeper connections that we're always like tunnel vision down the rabbit's hole as much as possible. Sometimes it's just small little stuff like this, just a tiny little connection.
Yeah. And that's the thing, man. It's like some people are like, oh, you guys are reaching or you're looking too far. And it's like, nah, not really.
You don't have to, man.
I'm not saying that some theories aren't completely crazy, but I'm just saying that like the intention, there's so much intention behind the sentences that George writes. It's staggering.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's it for the reread today. So let's dive into, we did have a Raven. So let me get this pulled up here. So this is from Joe, who says, do you guys think George has been writing Winds of Winter and A Dance of Dragons side by side and is going for a double release? We know how long it has taken to get him to the stage, but it could be because he has been doing double the writing. He recently said one wish he had is that he'd always finish the books and that he had some things in previous books he wishes he could change. Could he be writing them together? So it leaves him free to make any changes to Winds needing to instead of releasing it. Interested in your perspective on this. We've talked
Matt, about this before. Matt, do you want to go first? You want the good news or bad news is the question.
Well, we've talked about this before. I've talked about the possibility of him writing, you know, being like, hey, maybe he's actually done with Winds and he's writing A Dream of Spring. Right. And that I certainly don't think that he would ever double release.
Oh, no. The publisher would never allow it.
Yeah. That I don't think would happen. I do still believe in the possibility of like, oh, he's actually writing A Dream of Spring. So that we can be like, oh, it's all done. And like Winds is going to come out first and then whatever. And he might. And the reason I say that, too, is if you look really more at the way he talks about his writing process, I feel like Dream of Spring is probably going to be very much like A Dance of Dragons was for A Feast for Crows, in that there's going to be a lot of stuff that he wanted in Winds of Winter that's going to have to be pushed into A Dream of Spring. And so I would say that I actually do believe in the idea that he's writing both books at the same time, mostly because a lot of Wind stuff is going to have to carry over into A Dream. And so he's going to be like, well, which am I going to pick and which am I going to choose? Much like how Winds of Winter is already having a bunch of stuff from Dance of Dragons that was supposed to be in Dance of Dragons get pushed over, which A Dance of Dragons had a bunch of stuff for Feast. So I don't know what happened in his process when maybe he originally was writing this and he was thinking it's supposed to be 3 books, 3 turned into 5.
5-year gap.
And once he hit, because clearly, I mean, everything's fine up until Storm of Swords. And then once you hit Feast, I think it just overgrew him. And he's just like, all right, I got to introduce somebody here to deal with this character's arc so that it'll get me back to this. And
yeah, I don't have any reason to believe that he's writing the two books at once. I don't think he is. Now, will some of Wins end up in Dream of Spring because it's cut or something? Yeah, that could happen. But I don't think that he's writing two books simultaneously on purpose. I think that he has written two books, though. And I think that that book is the same book. I think he's completely rewritten The Winds of Winter. I think he got to a point.
At this point, yeah.
Yeah, I think something... We will one day know, most likely, whether it was a complete rewrite or my conspiracy theory, as far as I'm willing to go, is that maybe his computer crashed. I know that sounds crazy, but like George was working on a DOS 32-bit system. Like there's a chance that something happened, but I think it's probably more likely that he has just restarted the book once or maybe even twice. To be honest, though, Matt, I don't think it's going to be done in two books. I don't think it's possible. I think that it's more likely to be three or four books. I think that if there are two books, it'll be Winds of Winter split, which for the love of God, just do it. Just do it, dude.
Yeah. I mean, I think right now he could probably straight up just publish like Winds of Winter and it'd be half of what Winds of Winter was supposed to be. And it'll still be like a full book.
It'll be 600 pages long and there's plenty of climax points you could end on.
Yeah.
And you know, I think he's very frustrated that he went from three books. Okay, I'm going to do five. And now he's at seven. I think he likes the number seven because seven has right. a lot of representation in the series. And overall, also just like seven in general is like a decent number. And I think that he is so worried about getting it done in seven that it probably is actually lengthened the process instead of he just started splitting books and said, you know, forget it. It's going to be nine books. It's going to be nine and a half books. It doesn't matter. He could have easily been releasing shorter things. And that is one thing he said in his blog is like, man, maybe I should have made these books a little bit shorter.
Because even if you compare it to other book series, I mean, like take The Wheel of Time, for example.
Yeah.
I haven't read nearly as many fantasy series as Jimmy has. So, you know, I don't know as much about, you know, how they all work. Right. But Wheel of Time is something I'm a little more familiar with. And, you know, I mean, some of the books are like really big and some are really small, even like Harry Potter. You know, that ended up being seven books. And, you know, like, what is it? Goblet of Fire is massive compared to like Prisoner of Azkaban and some of the other books.
Books tend to grow in fantasy, which is annoyance of mine. Cause usually it's an author getting some leeway from his editor. That's usually what that means. But there's also series that are exceptions to that rule. I mean, Joe Abercrombie's written 10 books in the First Law universe that are all, I think, sub 650 pages. Roger Zelazny, who's that's Gurm's like favorite author. Roger Zelazny wrote 10 books and they're the size of a Storm of Swords. Like all of them. Like, I mean, like 10 of his books equal Storm of Swords. So he wrote a whole fantasy series within 10. Now George is going for grander scope and truly epic style fantasy, but there would have been no harm in George doing a 12 book series or a 13 book series and splitting every single thing in half. I mean, in the UK, a lot of the books have already been split. So, I mean, I guess the point of this is though, I don't have any reason to believe that he's also working on Dream of Spring. Does that mean that he doesn't have some of it written? No, because I remember hearing from Daniel Abraham that George has actually written the last paragraph of A Song of Ice and Fire, the last page of it. So like there is plans for an ending that have somewhat been written out, but like, I don't think we're going to see like, hey guys, Wins is done. And then next year we're going to see a Dream of Spring. I don't think we'll ever see the final book. And regardless, I don't think it's going to be done in two anyways. I think it's a fool's errand.
Yeah, I mean, A Feast for Crows is short compared to the rest of the
comparatively series. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so I think I'd be fine also if he wanted to cut, let's just say you took like the first, I don't know, half or even third of it, and it was much more focused on like Daenerys and all this other stuff, then you could still keep the name Winds of Winter. And it could be like, I don't know, the dragons, something or other. You know what I mean? Like something to do more with like Essos. And it's just like a big.
Yeah.
Because there's, I mean, even if you were just taking like, all right, I'm going to do like deal with like Tyrion and Daenerys and Jorah Mormont and like all the stuff that's literally just Essos. Right. I mean, you could just do that. And Arya and like just it's just like an Essos book.
Dude, it's so much.
There's so much you could do with just that, and then just call it, I don't know, whatever you want, something to do with like the cats, whatever. I don't know. You know, I mean, like you could do anything, you could title anything, and then you could like shift it all over. There's so much you could do. Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes I wonder, like, the new age thing now that people do is they release novellas that focus on, like, little angles and kind of, like, filter their way into the main series. And I almost wish that there's 100% some of the stuff that could have been, like, novellas between the novels. I'm not talking about Duncan Egg. I'm talking about, like, for the main series. Like, a lot of Arya stuff probably could have been done as a novella. Yeah. I don't know what you would do with it. You know, it's all hindsight 2020 at this point. But one of the things that makes this so difficult is I bet George has to reread his books quite a bit, because when I talked to Stephen Erickson, who wrote 10 books, I'd be like, dude, in book six, I couldn't believe when this happened. He's like, did that happen? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, I don't know. Like, I literally can't remember what I wrote. He's like, I had to constantly be rereading my own stuff to remember all the tiny details. So I'm sure George is also just having a hell of a time having to reread all the time. Like, what did I say? What was this horse's gender? I can't remember. You know, this continuity errors and stuff like that start to creep up if you don't have a good grasp on what you've written. And as surprising as it sounds, very hard to remember everything that you've penned. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I did look up Oath Keeper. The reason I was struggling to find it earlier is because I kept typing, it's because the wiki of Westeros, which is the Game of Thrones one, which I never use, kept wanting to take me to Oath Breaker, the episode, not the sword. And Brienne just keeps it. That's it. Yeah, that's just sort of what I thought, was Brienne just has it at the end of when she's sitting down with Bran the Broken in the final episode. She's just got it. So
cool, guys. Cool.
So we have no idea what happens to Widow's Wail. I think it just disappears.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? So. We kind of forgot.
Yeah, but they kind of forgot about that. So, all right. Well, hey, that is it for us in this episode. Jimmy and I, like I said, we'll be doing a Patreon episode at some point here about the new outline for House of the Dragon season three and potentially season four, now that we have a little more information, thanks to George R. Martin. But next, as always, we want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. Our next episode will be A Storm of Swords, Chapter 33, Samwell 2.
And if you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, or leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com or bendtheknee@podcast.com.
We'll see you next time. And remember that winter is coming.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.